The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Good Things Now, the fourth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled, Why Keep the Feast? Given for the fourth day of the Feast of Tabernacles, in Townsend, Tennessee, October 20th, 2024.
So we're covering items on the list of why we keep the feast. And, you know, this isn't rocket science. These are pretty simple, straightforward, right? Yeah, why do we keep the feast? One, we believe in a God, and we believe in a God who created a set of laws, including the requirement to keep Sabbaths and holy days. And so we've also then, recognized that, you know, there are benefits, certainly, to the keeping of those holy days. We look forward to the time when Jesus Christ is going to be the king over this earth and rule. And so yesterday I went through a description of many of the texts in the Bible which show what that new reign upon this earth is going to be like and how it differs from what is going on right now, what we're used to in this evil world. The day is coming when it's not going to be an evil world anymore because there's going to be a new king and it's going to be a glorious paradise upon this earth, like the Garden of Eden, except over the entire globe. And for that 1,000 years, Satan is not going to be allowed to be there to deceive and to harm and to upset. So it is going to be an insulated period of time, which is going to be glorious for human beings. So that's a great reason to keep the feast, because of what it pictures, the optimism of the future, and that's going to be glorious. So what's another reason to keep the feast? If someone were to ask you, as I mentioned to you on opening night, why do you go to that, you know, kind of funny religious retreat for over a week in the fall? Here's another answer that you might provide. Because God has promised blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience. You may not tell this to people in the world who would ask. But I don't know. Some of you would, actually. But for you and me, it is true. Another good reason to keep the feast, not just because God said so, but he said so with consequences. There are blessings for those who show respect and honor for God and his laws and follow through to observe them. And on the other hand, there are penalties, i.e. curses, when we do not. So if you recall on the Day of Atonement, the message that I provided for all of you, when I was listening, the benefits of atonement or at one-ment with God, and I went through kind of a laundry list. So this is somewhat in concert with that. But if you recall, we read the first 14 verses, I think, of Deuteronomy 28, which is a long list where God says, here's all the things that you'll get. Here's all the good stuff you get if you obey me and respect my commandments. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 28. And it's the positive part. 1 through 14 is the good side of the coin, if you will. Just, you know, very quickly, I'm going to summarize. Verse 1 said, If thou hearken diligently unto the voice of the Eternal thy God to observe all of his commandments. And then verse 3, blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shalt the fruit of thy body, the fruit of thy ground, the fruit of thy cattle, the increase of thy kind, the flocks of thy sheep. Blessed shall be the basket of thy store. Blessed shalt thou be when thou comest in. Blessed shalt thou be when thou goest out. It keeps going with this long litany of benefits for the ones who make God a priority, put him first, and keep those commandments, including keeping of Sabbath and holy days. Verse 14 says, and thou shalt not go aside from any of the words which I command thee this day, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods to serve them. All right. Then, I didn't have it in here, but I'm going to turn in my Bible. I'm going to pick it up. Now, I'm not going to read the rest of chapter 28. But starting in verse 15, then is the other side of the coin. Verse 15, but it shall come to pass, if thou will not hearken unto the voice of the Eternal thy God, to observe and do all the commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Now we start a long list. And it goes all the way to the end of the chapter. It goes all the way to verse 68. Let me just read a few of them. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It'd be too depressing. Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field. Cursed shall be the basket of thy store. Cursed shall be the fruit of thy body, the fruit of thy land, the increase of thy kind, the flocks of thy sheep. Cursed shall be thou be when thou comest in, and cursed shalt thou be when thou goest out. The Eternal shall send upon thee cursing, vexation, rebuke, and all that thou settest thine hand to do, until thou be destroyed, and until thou perish quickly, because of the wickedness of thy doings, whereby thou hast forsaken me. The Eternal shall make the pestilence cleave unto thee, until he hath consumed thee from the land whither thou goest to possess it. The Lord shall smite thee with a consumption, and with a fever, and with an inflammation, and with an extreme burning, and with the sword, and with the blasting, and the mildew, and they shall pursue thee until thou perish, and thy heaven that is over thy head shall be brass, and the earth that is under thee shall be iron. Do I need to go on? That's not nice stuff. And yet this is your loving God. This, in fact, the one who inspired this through Moses is the one who became Jesus Christ. Same being. But these are the kind of texts that don't make us feel that way. But it's true. But the point of the whole thing is, built in to this universe and to this earth and to all that you know physically, is a set of laws which are real. Many of them are invisible, but they are nonetheless real. And there really are benefits for respecting them, and there are absolute curses for disrespecting them. It's not about putting on a front for other people to make other people think we're doing good. Because these curses happen very much on autopilot. Yes, in many cases it can be God making an individual choice, you know, to zap one of us with a lightning bolt or to bless with a miracle. But there's a whole lot of these things that it doesn't require God to be on duty, because he built into the system on autopilot for these laws to work and cause and effect. And they just happen. And so here is a description of all the things where God has literally revealed the reality of these laws. And he's saying, if you respect them and work within them, you're going to be so much better off than if you disobey them, either in ignorance or on purpose. It doesn't matter. The laws are real. The consequences, both good and bad, are real. So a great reason to keep the Feast of Tabernacles is because one of those laws. And there are blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience. Romans 2, verse 14. I find myself quoting this a lot, but it is so relevant. Romans 2, beginning in verse 14, the Apostle Paul was inspired to clarify a very important point concerning the laws of God. And he says, for when the Gentiles, and again, a Gentile is just simply anyone separated from God. It doesn't matter what nationality, race, culture, background you are, anyone who is separated from God is a Gentile. So when the Gentiles, people who don't know God, and which have not the law, meaning they're not like Israel that had God reveal to them his Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgment. So these are people who aren't in a covenant relationship with God, and yet they have an opportunity to respect a lot of the laws of God. How and why? We'll see. When the Gentiles, which have not the law, they haven't been taught it, but they do by nature the things contained in the law. These, having not the law, are a law unto themselves. What does that mean? This is basically saying there are a lot of God's laws which can be proven by human beings. You don't have to be religious. You don't have to be in God's church. By experience and by teaching in the world, you can figure out there's things that will make you happy and things that will make you sad. So, number one that I use is the law of gravity. How long does it take a little child to figure out that there is a law called gravity? They may not know it by name, but when they fall down and hurt their knee, they are aware that there is a force in their life which takes its toll. And so they learn over time how to take care of their bodies and how to balance and to avoid falling down, to avoid injury, because injury is painful. It's a curse. It's a negative element. So just acknowledging the law of gravity and the way you move your body and the way you get up and the way you get down is taking into consideration one of those commandments of God, because it's a law. And so even when people, you don't have to be religious, you don't have to be in the church of God, to recognize certain laws. And now we're talking about all the physical laws which human beings upon the earth can come to know and either respect or not. And so what Paul is saying is, you know what? You don't have to be in the church to come to respect a lot of laws and to receive the blessings instead of the cursings. When the Gentiles which have not the law, no special revelation, but do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves. They make God's laws in that regard their own, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness in their thoughts, the meanwhile accusing or excusing one another. You can read the book of Proverbs and find all kinds of wisdom for living. I remember I was a teenager when my mother recommended that I read the book of Proverbs. She must have thought I needed it. And I did. But I read it. I mean, I was, you know, raised memorizing passages in the Bible and all of that. But sit down and read the book of Proverbs and just think about it from a physical standpoint. Forget religion for a moment, but literally, if you will apply the principles that are there concerning wisdom, how to treat other people, how to deal with difficult circumstances when you are confronted with a negative influence. Like when the Bible says, don't answer a fool according to his folly, or in some cases you do. There's all of this wisdom for living. And you don't have to care about God or the Bible, but there's a book of wisdom right there. And if you will apply these principles in the way you interact with people in the world, in the workplace, in school, you will make your life better. It's there, because this stuff works. I am one that when I was young, yes, raised in the church, taught this is God's church and these are your commandments, da 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 da, great. But I got old enough to have to start thinking for myself and making decisions on my own. And I had to decide whether I thought my parents' religion was true or whether it was just kind of their thing. I came to the personal conclusion, I don't know exactly when I did it, but somewhere along the line, I came to the conclusion that I thought these principles were real and that they affected me, and that I could not escape them even if I wanted to. And I was kind of upset about that, because I didn't want to be subject to a law. I wanted to be able to make my own rules and do things my own way. I had a lot of things to accomplish. I had places to go, people to see, and things to do. And all these laws that I was taught was a huge infringement upon my freedom. But I did come at some point to believe that they were real as the law of gravity or thermodynamics or any of these other things that I could prove. And so I ultimately made the decision, because I came to believe, in essence, that Deuteronomy 28 was true. The laws were real, and therefore the consequences were real. And that if I respected the laws, I could have good things, and if I disrespected the laws, I would suffer. I came to believe that that was true. I didn't come to want religion. I didn't care about church. But I did come to believe that the law did bind me upon this earth. And I wanted the good things and not the bad things. And I've told this story, a number of you have heard it. Sorry to repeat myself, but I've been doing this 25 years now. It's hard for me to have new stories. But when I counseled for baptism with the minister under Mr. Raymond Cole here in Tennessee, it was where I was living at the time, I was 19 years old, and he asked me, "Why do you want to be baptized?" And I said, "To be honest, I really don't." I said, "But I have come to believe that the laws are real and that the consequences for sin are real. And I would like to have the blessings and not the cursings. And I know I'm going to need the power of God in order to achieve that." That was my answer. And he said, "Yep, you're ready." But I had already by that time lived in the world on my own and done a lot of things where I had a chance to choose and be tested and tempted and a lot of things, and kind of come to some of those conclusions apart from my family. But my message to anyone else who's young, I don't care whether you're 10 years old or whether you're 25 years old, you too have to come to a point where you make your own decisions regardless of how devoted your parents may be to their religion. And you have to decide for yourself what you believe is right and true. And you don't want to follow a way of life, a church or a religion, just because you don't want to upset the other people in your life. We're talking about a personal relationship with God. We are talking about your personal relationship with your Maker. And you will, sooner or later, have to stand on your own two feet for whatever choices and whatever path you take. Now, I believe the reason I'm a part of this church and joined it so many years ago is because I believe this is where you can find the support and the help and that communion with God. And I still believe it after all these years, and it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm a minister in this group. My point is, the way defined by commandments, you will verify one way or the other that these laws are real. And you can either do it the easy way or you can do it the hard way. Now, a lot of human beings, I got to do it the hard way. They won't believe in the curses until they experience the curses. And some are so hardened and committed to their own way in opposition to God that they'll take the curses and the pain and the sorrow and the misery and they'll just forge ahead without relent. The ones who are more wise, even if they go down that path, they find out the stove does have a burner, and if you touch it, you get burned, and then they stop doing that. And they're better off. Stop hitting your head against the brick wall. Stop touching the burner with your bare hand. Stop fighting against the reality of the law. And you will make your life better. And that's what Paul is talking about here. Even people who aren't in a close relationship with God, but who come to respect the body of laws which are real in this world and work within them instead of against them, they are so much better off. In other words, they take some of those laws of God and make them their own and prove the value of them by the results that they get in their life. Here's a quote. I got to quote Elon Musk. I'm not an Elon Musk fanboy. Some of you would disagree with that, I know. But here's one citation. You know, and he is one, by the way, who doesn't accept a creator God like we do. I would say he's probably more like an agnostic. Acknowledges a creative force in the universe that brought it all into being, but doesn't acknowledge that we have any obligation toward an existing being. Meaning he's definitely a humanist. Okay? Like Mr. Burke has been talking about, the idea we can solve our own problems. But here's what he said. Quote, it doesn't matter what anyone's opinion is, physics is the law. And everything else is a recommendation. He says, I've seen plenty of people break the law, but I've never seen anyone break physics. You can break any law made by humans, but try breaking a law made by physics. See, so he's in this category of Romans 2, of someone separate from God and yet recognizes an entire body of God's law defined under the laws of physics. And he knows they're real, they're absolute. And he's done some phenomenal things with engineering because he's worked within that to create some of the greatest marvels going on right now in the news. But see, there's somebody who recognizes immutable law and yet doesn't attach it to the personality of an invisible God behind it. One day he will. I'll reword it this way. You can disregard the law, but you can never break it. The laws are there and they are real. Argue against it, hate it, whatever. But the law is binding upon you. You can disregard them and suffer the consequences, but you will never eliminate the law. So the wise among us will learn to respect them. The law of God is the foundation of all blessing and cursing. Notice Proverb 26, verse 2. Proverb 26, verse 2 says, as the bird by wandering, as the swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come. Okay, that's kind of backward poetic wording. But what it's saying is there is no such thing as a curse which does not have a cause. It's substantiating the fact cause and effect. If it's a curse, meaning a negative result from a law, you can't have a curse if there's not a law involved. So a curse is a negative result from disrespecting or violating a law. If there's a curse, there's a reason for it. The curse, causeless, shall not come. In other words, there's no such thing as a causeless curse. There's always a cause when we suffer any kind of a curse. Now it gets into a big deal about, well, what's the source of it? Because I've been trying to keep God's law, and yet I'm suffering here and I'm suffering there. All right, we're going to get to that. And I'm not going to take the time to go through, you know, a lot of the curses we suffer are because we violate the law ourselves and we suffer the penalty. That's your fault, that's my fault. But there are some of them that we inherit from our ancestors. Now, be very careful about trying to say all of your problems came from your parents or your grandparents or your ancient ancestors, because that can often be a cop-out. But it is true, because even when God gave the Ten Commandments and listed them in Exodus 20, just paraphrasing, we're not turning there, you know, but he talked about those who disrespect those commandments and the curses even to the third and the fourth generation of those that hate me. Meaning those who disregard his commandments and do whatever they want, and they suffer the consequences, and then in many cases they pass on those curses to their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. So yes, other passages in Ezekiel where God says the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. What does that mean? Because if I eat a sour grape, I'm the one whose teeth set on edge, not my sons. So what is he talking about? He's talking about the kind of decision or the choice made by one generation that can negatively impact their children. Okay? So that's a real thing. There may be certain physical disabilities or mental difficulties or other circumstances which you didn't bring upon yourself, but it came down to you in a domino fashion. Okay? And that may be a reality that many of us, some of us, are dealing with. But don't try to put everything on that. Because even if you and I were given a perfect background and a circumstance, because of our personal rebellion against God's laws, our weakness, we would bring curses upon ourselves, regardless of what parents, grandparents did. Another, Proverbs 3, verse 33. Proverbs 3, 33 says, "The curse of the eternal is in the house of the wicked." Wicked, oh, just those bad people. Let's turn the mirror on ourselves. That's us by nature. Wicked is just somebody, again, who's living in opposition to the set of rules that God gave us, which he said are right. If we disregard God's law, we are wicked. "The curse of the eternal is in the house of the wicked, but he blesses the habitation of the just." He blesses the habitation of the just. Thank God he is long-suffering and merciful and compassionate to forgive our sins and to help us. And he is. But he's trying to emphasize the fact that these laws are real and he wants us to take it seriously. And the one who is eligible for miraculous intervention to heal minds and bodies are the ones who are not thumbing their nose at him and his laws, but the ones who acknowledge their existence and are doing the best they can to get better at obedience. I guarantee you the one who denies that he is or that his laws are real or want to argue like a lawyer about the context of his laws so that they can do whatever they want to do, like Mr. Burke has been talking about, the Babylonian philosophy, they're not going to receive God's benefits. If you want to be one who gets the special miracles where God reaches down and actually gives you an intervention to help you against a former curse, something bad going on, or to help you in a special way, be one who acknowledges him and acknowledges the reality of his law and the goodness of his law, and be willing to show by your fruits that you desire to obey. And then as a loving parent, he will come to your rescue and he will help you along the way. But that's very different than the rebellious child who's going to run in the opposite direction no matter what the parent does. Yes, there is a built-in cause and effect result from obedience or rejection of the law. And that is God's way to establish the force of the law. That's what I'm going to call it. Like I said, you can't break the law. You can disregard the law, but you'll never break it because it's there. The force of the law is real. And the wise will acknowledge it. Deuteronomy 11, verse 26. Here's another, again, where God put before Israel, but before every one of us, a choice. We are free moral agents. We each get to choose. He's not going to force anybody to do anything. He's looking for volunteers, in essence. Deuteronomy 11, 26, "Behold," he says, "I set before you this day a blessing and a curse." Two paths with two different results. Blessing on one hand, a way of curses on the other. Verse 27, "A blessing if you obey the commandments of the eternal your God, which I command you this day, and a curse if you will not obey the commandments of the eternal your God, but turn aside out of the way which I command you this day to go after other gods which you have not known. Therefore," one reason to keep the feasts, including this Feast of Tabernacles, is that there are curses if you do not. If you know better, And I think my audience here and those who will hear this by recording after the feast is over, you're ones who know. You've been called by God. You've been enlightened enough to understand, even if you're asking the questions, I wonder if, maybe I should. Yeah, you're probably called, which means you're probably being held accountable by God. Remember on the opening night, we read a passage from Zechariah 14. Remember in trying to prove that God commanded it and that the feast have not been done away. And what did we read? Am I going to turn back there in Zechariah 14? Where everyone in the kingdom under Jesus Christ's rule of the millennium is going to be keeping the feast, the tabernacles? And what's going to happen to the ones who refuse to go up to keep the feast? They're going to get a curse, aren't they? Now, that is not one that appears to be an immediate built-in cause and effect in the physical, in the physics of it. It seems to be a purposeful, personalized curse by the king. Because it says the families who refuse to go up to the feast as commanded are not going to get rain the next year. That's almost as if the king is going to intervene in the weather patterns so that right over their property it doesn't rain. The neighbors it will. That's kind of specialized. But my point is, again, it's still the same cause and effect. The feasts are important to God. They tell the plan that he is using to bring salvation to the entire human family. So he's serious about it. And the ones who disrespect it, there is a penalty. They will suffer for their choice. The ironic, sad news is the very called people of God, ancient Israel, were the ones who received the most curses. Now, they should have been the most blessed, right? I mean, God called them out, made them a nation, and he said, not because you were more worthy. They were the weakest and the smallest of people, and yet God was going to use them as an example. Well, he sure, certainly did. But here, he held them by the hand, and he made a nation of them and made a covenant with them and said, if you will keep these laws, which are immutable, I will give you special favor and blessings, and I'll walk before you and defend you, and I'll take you into this promised land. You'll have all this bounty. So they should have enjoyed the greatest blessings, and only for short times in history did they do it because they could never stay with it. Then they'd fall off the wagon. They'd start incorporating all of this, heathenism from the nations around them, their carnal minds working away. And before you know it, they're not keeping Sabbaths and holy days. They're not doing what God told them to do. And so then they receive the curses that God said, like in Deuteronomy 28, what happened? Turn with me to Daniel 9, verse 11. Here's a synopsis of the end result of the physical nation of Israel. Daniel 9, verse 11, yea, all Israel hath transgressed thy law. That's how God sees it. All Israel have transgressed thy law, even by departing, that they might not obey thy voice. They didn't want it. Therefore, because of their choices to disregard and to walk away and deny God and his laws, therefore the curse is poured upon us, and the oath that is written in the law of Moses, like Deuteronomy 28, the oath that is written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, because we have sinned against him. And he hath confirmed his words, which he spake against us and against our judges that judged us. How? By bringing upon us a great evil. For under the whole heaven hath not been done as hath been done upon Jerusalem. Wow. That's quite a statement by God. To say, after all those generations of the Israelites down to the days of Daniel, under the whole heaven hath not been done as hath been done upon Jerusalem. In other words, God says, they end up receiving the greatest curses on the earth. The ones who should have been the most blessed, and in fact, they were the opposite. Isn't that ironic? But again, the entire history of ancient Israel was written as a lesson book for you and me. Now, the good news for them, you see, is those people who lived, they made their choices, their bad choices, they suffered the penalties, and they died, and they're in the grave right now. They all get to come up when the millennium is over. We're going to talk about that on the last great day. And a great resurrection back to flesh and blood, and have a chance for the first time to come into a close relationship with God. They didn't have that the first time around. So they've not had their one chance. So they just wrote physical lessons about what human beings do by nature with their carnal mind when they don't have the Holy Spirit. And that's the end result. Now, you and I are different because we have been called. We have had the Holy Spirit open to us, which means God is holding us accountable. But now he wants us to learn from the poor choices of those ancestors so that we might be warned and make better choices. God is the one with supreme authority to bless or to curse in love. That's the hard thing for us to fathom sometimes, agree with. It is a work of love. Did you have one of those parents who would say, if they punished you, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you? One, if you were ever spanked. I was. But if you have parents that said, this is going to hurt me more than this hurts you, in my mind I'm thinking, that's not the way I see it. But from the parent's standpoint, now you grow up, if you have your own children, now you get to understand, don't you? As a loving parent, you really do want what is good for your children, and you would love to be able to instill in them the wisdom so that they can avoid making mistakes that will harm them. Because you'd like for them to be happy and fulfilled and blessed. And so if you try to establish rules in your home for your children, is it really because you're trying to keep them down or do something bad to them or just show you're the boss? If you're a wise parent, you're trying to instill in them the principles that will make them a happy adult. That's the way God does it. It's an entire operation based in true parental love. It's just that you and I don't often see it that way either, as children of God. But it's true. Hebrews 12, verse 6. Hebrews 12, verse 6. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens. So a loving parent, God says, does discipline his children. So those, all these newfangled ideas about parenting, I like the old term, child rearing. That's the job. Parenting. Whom the Eternal loves, he chastens. You discipline your children if you love them. Not as an outgrowth of anger. You're not acting out and making your child the target of your negative emotion. Well, sadly, parents do that. That's not what we're talking about. That's not how God does it. Nevertheless, it's true. A loving, wise parent guides those children through discipline to teach them good habits that will help them when they become independent adults on their own. That's the purpose of good child rearing. Whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening as a child, now if you endure the correction of your parents positively, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chastens not? Well, I'll tell you a whole passage of them in the world today. But when it's done right, according to this set of laws and rules for humanity upon this earth, and when parents, in or out of the church, it doesn't matter, but there's a wise approach to dealing with children. When parents recognize these are little human beings who are going to grow up and be independent adults. I only have them for a short period of time in my home. But what I'm doing is trying to guide this young person with the kind of habits and the philosophies that will help them become happy on their own. And if parents make their choices that way and how they deal with their children, they're going to do a lot better. And helping be a blessing to their children rather than a curse to their children. And none of us do it right. Not all the way, but God does. As a parent, He's perfect. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is he whom the father chastens not? Verse 8. But if you be without chastisement, you grow up like a wild weed because your parents let you do anything you want. If you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, all should be partakers, then are you bastards and not sons. This is talking about illegitimate children that parents don't care about. They don't love them. So they don't take the time and the energy. They make no sacrifices to correct, to guide, to teach. They were just a mistake. And this is the example God inspired to explain the differences in how God could treat us. Well, He doesn't treat us as bastards. We're all His beloved children, whom He created in His image for the purpose, ultimately, of being born into His glorious eternal family, if we will. So He is going to give us loving correction. And a big part of that is with the natural law, which works on autopilot. Plus, then, if you're not just one of those in the world that God's not dealing with for the most part yet, and they're suffering according to time and chance, under that law, the laws of physics, thermodynamics, and all of the other ones. But if you're called by God, now He's taken a personal interest in you, and you're not like the people in the world. You're not subject to time and chance. And now you've not only got the physical laws, which work on autopilot, you've also got God intervening, creating circumstances to try to teach you and me. This is a good way to go. This is a bad way to go. Like in how we treat a Sabbath and holy days is one example. Be careful of criticizing God's use of both blessing and cursings to teach and guide His children, because they're both a part of the loving training program of our Heavenly Father, both the good things in the blessing side and the curses, when they're important for us to learn lessons. Remember, the end goal of God is that we each be born into His eternal family. He would like us to share all eternity with Him and with Jesus Christ, which means anything we have to suffer now for a very short period of time in the flesh, it doesn't even count on the timeline. So if we need to learn hard lessons to come to respect the law and to become motivated enough to respect it, it's worth it. We don't think so. We just want the pain to go away. God, please relieve me of this suffering. Please help solve this problem for me. And He is a God of blessings, and He's promised. That's what the first part of Deuteronomy 28 says. He's going to walk before us. He's going to make all our enemies run at our sight. We're going to have all this good stuff, but it's conditional. If you are frustrated that you're not getting good things from God, beware. The frustration, is God ever evil? Is He ever absent? Would He ever treat you like a bastard? The answer is no. So if you're frustrated, and the frustration is natural, well, I'm trying my best, and I know I'm not perfect, but I don't eat pork, and I don't keep Christmas. These are the go-tos, by the way. People that I grew up with in the church and others. Well, I don't eat pork, and I don't keep Christmas. Yeah, but are you keeping the feast? Are you really honoring the Sabbath? Are you trying to keep all 10 of the 10 commandments, including the first four that talk about how to serve God and the last six about how to serve others? Are you keeping all of them? You see, that's where we have to do that analysis, which is pictured by Passover and unleavened bread. And we have to do that all year long. Genesis 4, verse 5. Here's the first noted individual who was frustrated because he didn't get good things, and it was Cain. There's a lot that we can learn from Cain. Genesis 4, verse 5, unto Cain, unto his offering, he had not respect. He gave a command about an offering, and the Genesis account here, revealed through Moses, did not give the details. I would love to know more about what was specifically commanded for how to do an offering back then. All we're told is that Abel followed the rules and God respected his offering. Cain, no. Unto Cain and his offering, God had no respect. He didn't accept Cain's offering. And Cain was very wroth and his countenance fell. He was all upset and put out. And I can just see it. Well, you wanted an offering and I gave an offering. I went out of my way. Here is my offering. Why are you not accepting my offering? That's not fair. In other words, it's pointing the finger at God. I'm trying my best to respect you and honor you. I did bring you an offering. Why did you accept my brother's and not mine? I think you're just partial. And how did God reply? Verse 6, the Eternal said unto Cain, why are you wroth? Cain, why are you upset? And why is your countenance fallen? Why you got that pouty lip out there? Verse 7, here's the answer in the back of the book. God says, if you do well, i.e., if you respect the rules, the laws, the instructions that I give you, if you do well, that's what it means to do well, shall you not be accepted? If you actually follow my instructions, if you show me that respect, to do it the way I said to do it, won't I give you the blessing? In other words, this is God defending himself against Cain's accusation that God's not being fair. You just like my brother better than me. And God's saying, if you actually do what I said to do, won't I bless you as much as I bless your brother? And if thou doest not well, if you don't follow the rules, what's the culprit? Sin lies at the door. Sin. What is sin? 1 John 3:4. Sin is the transgression of the law. That's what sin is. That means doing opposite from what God said is the right thing to do. Cause and effect. The law is real. It's either blessing or cursing. Respect it or disrespect it. You can't break the law, but you can suffer the curse of the law. And that's exactly what Cain got. So God says, if you respect the law, you get accepted and you get the blessings. And if you get bad things, don't point your finger at me, God says. There's sin involved in this thing somewhere. There's a violation of the law, which is bringing a curse. And there's where you need to focus, is what he's saying. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. What's that mean? That's pretty obscure. He's talking about our carnal minds and our inclination, opposite from God. By nature, he gave you and he gave me a nature that doesn't like God's way and wants to do our own thing. We're hardwired to rebellion. Okay? And so what God is saying to Cain and to all of us by extension is, he set it up this way so that in order to get the blessings, you and I are going to have to resist our natural urges. If you and I go along with the flow, we're going to get the curses. The only way to get the blessings is I'm going to have to recognize the law of God separate and apart from me, and I'm going to have to set a course in my life to actually go out of my way against my natural inclination to keep the law instead of violate the law. I wish God hadn't done it that way. I wish He'd made it easy for me to want to keep His law so that I could more naturally and easily have the good things. According to His wisdom for our development of character, though, He made it opposite. So you have to resist. I have to resist and fight against what I think is right by my nature and suppress that, which is what crucifixion is all about. Self-crucifixion in the example of Jesus Christ is to kill what comes by nature and replace it with something totally outside of yourself, the mind of God. Cain didn't have that. Ancient Israel didn't have that mind. You have to get it from God. Our natural inclination, you've heard me say this, feels so right it can't be wrong. I have this strong feeling within me, whatever it is, something I want to eat, something I want to drink, someone I think is very hot and I want a relationship with, whatever the, compelling thing. And separate and apart from a set of guidelines that God gives us to say what's right and wrong, what's good and evil, I'm just going to go for what my mind and my body desires. And the end result of that is going to be bad things. That's the whole context of what God is trying to teach us. That we're going to have to restrain ourselves from the impulses that come to our minds and our bodies naturally, and harness it in line with a set of rules that God gave us for our good. If really you want the good things instead of the bad things. I'll let you read James 4, 1 through 10 on your own, where the Apostle James was inspired to address this in the church with church members who are frustrated. And because they're trying to live according to God's way. And yet, they're not getting good things. And James was inspired to say, it's because you're really serving the lust in your members. Even though outwardly you're talking about, keeping God's law and going to church and tithing and going to the feast and whatever else. But really, in your heart and mind, you're still seeking what you want by nature. So he called them, in verse 4, adulterers and adulteresses. And all these other things. But I want to finish by looking at Isaiah 58. I love this chapter. Here is the classic case study of a group of people called by God, because this was written by, inspired through Isaiah to Israelites. These are part of the called people of God who were on the inside track to get the blessings and avoid the curses, meaning they had a right to it if they followed those rules. And yet they're frustrated. Isaiah 58, verse 1, cry aloud, the commission to Isaiah, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression in the house of Jacob their sins. Verse 2, yet they seek me daily. Here are these Israelites. They were religious. It says they were seeking the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They're saying, you're my God. I'm not an atheist. I'm not denying you, and I'm not trying to walk away from your law. I acknowledge you and your law, and I'm one of your children. They seek me daily and delight to know my ways. They want to be taught the truth. As a nation that did righteousness, as if they were, God is saying, not that they were, but as if they were good Christians. Here they are, all going to church, dressing up, behaving themselves. They sure look like they got the package. And as if they forsook not the ordinance of their God, as if they were respecting the law and being obedient. They ask of me ordinances of justice. They're saying, we're with you, God. We want to fulfill your will, show respect for you, and we want the blessings that you've promised to go with it. They take delight in approaching unto God, meaning assemblies on Sabbaths and holy days. So these are not God deniers. But there's a problem. Verse 3, they're frustrated. They say, wherefore have we fasted? Like keeping the Day of Atonement, which is one of those commands. And they say, we obeyed. We're coming in assembly. We fasted. We didn't eat anything, eat or drink anything for that 24 hours. We fasted. Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not. Sound a little bit like Cain. Wherefore have I brought you an offering, and yet you didn't accept it? I'm on the outside looking in. You're blessing others, but you're not blessing me. Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and to God they say, you see not. Wherefore have we afflicted our soul? Look at all we've sacrificed, and thou takest no knowledge. Frustrated. Frustrated church members. How does God answer? Oh, this is valuable. God says, behold, in the day of your fast, while you're doing your religious service, ostensibly showing respect for me, like fasting, either personal fasting or fasting on the Day of Atonement, you find pleasure and exact all your labors. In essence, God was reading their hearts and minds and saying, outwardly, you're going through the motions, but you're not really doing it the way you're supposed to. You're not doing it as a respect for me. You're using your religion, you're using your position or your participation in the church to get something selfish, which is not right. Verse 4, behold, God says, you fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. Now, not any one of us was, I'm not doing that. And I beg that, and I'm sure that's the way they viewed it too. What? I don't know what you're talking about, God. God says, you shall not fast as you do this day, to make your voice to be heard on high. You see, there was something selfish going on in their religion or their practice of religion. And this is the subtlety of our human minds. And boy, we can lie to ourselves and deceive ourselves so we don't even realize it. But God knows. And in this case, these frustrated Christians, law keepers, who were not receiving the blessings that they thought they should get because they were going through the motions to keep the law. If I keep the law, I get the blessing, right? Okay, here, I'm keeping the law. Where's my blessing? And then they're, in essence, accusing God of reneging on the promise. And God's saying, oh, no, I didn't. You have a wrong orientation with your religion. And I want you to change that so you can get the blessing. Well, what's it going to be? Is God just saying, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but if you finally do it? No. He gives the answer. He gives the path. Verse 5, is it such a fast that I have chosen? Is this what I really, why I commanded fasting? Just for you to go through the motions, but you've got your own personal agendas you're trying to do. Like the Pharisees, remember Jesus Christ criticizing the Jews in his day? And what did he say about their fasting? You put on your sackcloth and your ashes and mope about because you want to be seen by other human beings that you're fasting. You want other human beings to think you're so religious and so close to God. And what did he tell them? You've already received your reward. If you get respect from other human beings who you convince you're religious and close to God, be happy with that reward because you're not getting nothing from me. So, yeah, I'm paraphrasing the way Jesus, he didn't say it quite like that in the Gospels, but you get the message. This is the same spirit. going through the motions, you know, physically to be religious and to obey the law, but they're not fulfilling the spirit behind the law at all. Is this such a fast that I've chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush, to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast, an acceptable day of the Lord? Meaning you're doing it to be seen by other human beings, not really to show respect and honor for me. Verse 6, is not this the fast that I have chosen? Now God is revealing what he's really looking for. This is what I want. Is this not the fast that I have chosen? Here's the answer. To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke. Well, what's that talking about? In this case, he's talking about our relationship with one another. He's talking about the individual who's doing great at physical fasting, but at the very same time is not behaving correctly in relationship with other people. And therefore, they're under a curse. Oh, how am I oppressing anyone else? It's by lack of outgoing concern, sacrifice, and service. And it may very well be involved in holding a grudge. The number one way that we oppress someone else, and I compare it to locking them in a prison cell, is refusal to show mercy and forgiveness. Because we think they've done something, said something, or whatever that has offended us, and we think we're justified in withholding love and mercy from them. And God doesn't like it. So we can fast and we can do all these things spiritually, and until we get this right, this thing hidden, then we're not going to receive the blessing. We're still under a curse. Isn't that, didn't God repeat this? What did he say, you know, concerning husbands? You know, it's like, in essence, husbands, you better be treating your wives correctly. Show respect for them as the weaker vessel, lest your prayers be hindered. You see, the way we treat our family obligations can cause God to withdraw his special favor and protection and blessing from us. So get our relationships with others correct, he says, and then, along with your technical keeping of Sabbath, holy days, tithing, all these other things, that's how you get the promised blessings. Loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. You can't solve problems that are really not in your control. If someone has something against you, if they're holding a grudge against you, you can't force them into a reconciliation. But if there's any element that is in your power, that's like you holding the key to the prison cell. And if you're the one holding the key to the prison cell, God says he wants you to unlock it and let them free. So it may not be that case, but boy, it sure is worthy for you and me to do a deep dive into our own mind. To what extent are we locking someone else in a prison cell because we have hurt feelings? Verse 7, is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry? Outgoing concern for others, make sacrifices of our time and our energies. It's not just about using money as a method to serve, but it's an example. To deal thy bread to the hungry, that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house. When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him. Isn't this the same thing Christ said concerning that parable of the sheep and the goats? When he says, you know, the ones who have visited those in prison, clothed the naked, fed the hungry. And they said, when did we see you? He said, you know, in that you have served the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. So God is evaluating our love for him based upon how we treat one another. Same principle being spoken of here. When thou seest the naked, thou cover him, that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. It's not just, first, it's talking about your flesh and blood family responsibilities and obligations, but then think about it outside that with the family of God, your spiritual family. To what extent are we actually serving one another and fulfilling those obligations? Because it directly applies to how God views our service to Him. Verse 8, then, if we do those things, get to the root of those particular issues, and there may be some really painful things in that well. Maybe things we're inclined to cover up just because it's too painful to uncover. So we'd just rather let it lie. And yet we may be under a perpetual curse until we finally deal with it and get it right. But if we do, if we finally address it, if we bite the bullet and we address some of these things, even that may have been long-standing, here's the reward, verse 8. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily. And thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Eternal shall be thy reward. Meaning not just an original reward, but the recovery of a lost reward. Something when you used to have it, when you used to feel blessed, and you lost it, and now you think God is against you, He's abandoned you. Here's how to get it back. Verse 9, then shalt thou call, and the Eternal shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and He shall say, here I am. Why? If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger. That's this. Pointing out somebody else's failure, holding someone else's feet to the fire, because we think they're misbehaving, and we have a right to treat them differently until they fix themselves. Be careful. I mean, there may be. You don't want to encourage or be a part of somebody's sin, but if it's just because we have hard feelings and we're not being willing to forgive, oh boy. There's a curse that goes with that. It's an invisible one, but it's real. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, the speaking vanity, empty stuff that doesn't matter. It's important to us, but to God He's saying, you're hung up on something that's worthless. You need to get over it. Verse 10, and if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, instead of focusing on yourself, me on myself, me, instead of a world where you interface with everybody and it's all about how this person upset me and whatever, it's like, get over yourself. And instead, focus yourself outward to become a servant. And I'm not just talking about doing like a lot of Christian churches do. They're going to go out and do good works. So I'm going to go spend next number of hours a week, you know, serving soup in the, you know, poorhouse or whatever. No, I mean a real sacrifice where you have to invest. Maybe it's because you're investing your time and your energy and being a sounding board for somebody who just needs to talk. What about that? If you draw out your soul to the hungry, satisfy the afflicted soul, you might be the one in the best position to help someone else in the body. You might have a rapport with them or an opportunity that others of us do not. Are you looking for those opportunities? Are you on the lookout? I'm not talking about, you know, oh, okay, who can I help? Oh, I'm going to help you. Here, come over here and let me help you. This all has to be tempered with wisdom, okay? God will guide you in that too. But if you turn yourself, get over yourself and turn yourself out to look for opportunities to help others solve a problem. That's what we're talking about. I guarantee you it's the number one way in order to start receiving additional blessings from God. Then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as the noonday. Verse 11, the Eternal shall guide thee continually. You want God to be in your corner, to feel like He's there with you all along the way? and satisfy the soul in drought, and make fat thy bones. Thou shalt be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose water fails not. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old places. Now is a long-range prophecy. Remember, concerning what we're going to see in the kingdom under Jesus Christ on this earth, where the old places are going to be rebuilt by who? Aha. The ones today who are born into the God family and now are going to rule with him and be a part of that reconstruction work. This is a promise about receiving salvation, because you've put on the mind of Jesus Christ. You've made his mind your own way of thinking. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, because you're going to be a part of the entourage of Jesus Christ in that day. The restorer of the paths to dwell in. Verse 13, restating of the condition. If thou turn thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the eternal honorable, and shall honor him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, not speaking thine own words. Here's the aspect of Sabbath keeping, which goes beyond just not going to your job. Well, I don't work on Saturday. Good. That's step one. How about this? There's a whole other aspect of Sabbath keeping, which is a whole lot harder to do. I understand it. Not doing, thinking, focusing on our own stuff on the Sabbath day, but making the Sabbath a day where we really think differently in our minds than we do the other 6 days of the week. And if you don't, I understand it. By nature, we don't love the Sabbath. Oh, I'm keeping the Sabbath, but I don't love it. Okay, God wants us to come to love the Sabbath. There is our next challenge. It's going to take his help. But if we do it, verse 14, then shall thou delight thyself in the eternal, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the eternal has spoken it. So he is a faithful God. His laws are real. Of his call, of which you were a part, he wants more than just an outward Pharisaical obedience to technical laws. Because the whole point of what we're doing is to be transformed in our thinking and our mind, to put on the love and the peace and the joy and the manifestation of the very mind of Jesus Christ. If we're doing that, even if we're taking baby steps in the right direction, I guarantee you this loving God is going to open up everything to you. But even as I said near the beginning, for those of you who are not members of the church, if you're young people in the church, if you're here because it's your parents' religion or aunt or uncle or somebody else, even if you just respect physically the existence of laws in this universe and on this earth, even if you never join the church, quote unquote, but you respect that there are principles that have consequences, either good or bad, I guarantee you, by comparison to these people out here in the world suffering every imaginable curse, you can be so much better off.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Good Things Now, the fourth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Why Keep the Feast, given for the fourth day of the Feast of Tabernacles in Townsend, Tennessee, October 20th, 2024.